Let's talk about first-line therapy again in patients without targetable mutations. We'll talk later about what that list is as it's growing. You know, this has really been a controversy for a few years now, the issue of how do you factor in PD-L1 level, Ben. And, you know, what we've seen over the years in general is kind of reflected here, that in general, people want to use combinations under 50%. In general, they want to use monotherapy unless the patient is symptomatic or needs a quick response. But we are seeing people, Govindan as well as Melissa, who kind of think more about the combination, even in patients with higher PD-L1s. How do you factor, of course, obviously, Ben, you have to consider the patient and how well they might tolerate chemotherapy. But right now, how are you factoring in the decision? Does it make a difference if it's 60 versus 90%, Ben?
Yeah, well, to answer that first question, I think we do have recent data that the PD-L1 is a continuous variable. And the higher the PD-L1, even above 50, the more likely you are to respond. So patients with 90 may respond better to checkpoint inhibitors than patients with 60. And this is some interesting data that's emerged. I think this treatment decision has to be individualized. And I think we all do this. And it's tough to dichotomize this. But, you know, I do look at patients' performance status. I do look at patients. I try to steer away from age as a factor. I just try to instead use performance status. I look at disease burden. I look at their symptoms to make a decision specifically for those patients over 50%, whether they should be getting single agent pembro or triplet therapy. I mean, I think we do cross-trial comparisons from KEYNOTE-189 and 024, showing that the hazard ratio may be a little bit more robust with the triplet therapy versus a single agent immunotherapy. Again, these are cross-trial comparisons, but overall, my decision for patients greater than 50%, I generally do default to single agent pembro. Patients in which I would consider a triplet therapy are those with high disease burden, patients where I'm not, you know, sure they can get to second line therapy, meaning they're sicker and they need to be what I call systemically debulked, and patients who may be a little more fit, I would consider using triplet therapy.
So Melissa, we saw a very similar reaction conceptually when we said it was a squamous cell, just a little bit different in terms of the chemo, obviously more, or taxanes basically, either of the two. Any comments again? It seems like maybe you kind of think more about the combination. Can you sort of talk a little bit about how you approach patients in this way?
Yeah, Neil, I agree with Ben's comments that it's not a dichotomy and every patient is an individual. But I've been burned more than a few times with a PD-L1 above 50% read from the pathologist. That is a semi-subjective call on their part. And the patient's response to single agent pembro. And in retrospect, sometimes we understand that it's because of STK11, for example, or some other resistance mutation that the patient harbors in their tumor. I get nervous when the patient has had a need for radiation prior to starting systemic therapy and has had some amount of steroids in their body before they've started treatment, brain radiation in particular. And I worry that pembro alone won't be effective for a while. And so the chemotherapy, sometimes I rationalize, will begin to cytoreduce the cancer while the T cells are revving up. I think no question patients are interested in a chemotherapy sparing regimen. And so I consider it, and now that Nivo-Ipi potentially is another option, we certainly should consider chemotherapy sparing regimens. But in general, I find patients want the best therapy. And in my mind, the chemo-containing regimen is preferable.
So maybe the most common question that we got, Leora, from these docs, at least related to immunotherapy, is actually kind of a great question to even think about, which is what happens in the patients who are doing real well in terms of potentially discontinuing therapy. And it looks like our faculty, you know, depending on the situation, the response, for example, maybe is a little bit split about whether or not to keep it going indefinitely or to stop at any particular time. It also, Leora, brings up the other question that I don't know that there's enough visibility about, which is that seems like we have a fair number of people who are actually making it to 5 years now. And the question of how are we really altering the biology and the long-term outcome of this disease? What's your approach, Leora? It looks like you're open to stopping therapy.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder if people would change their answers if you ask them now with COVID. But the reality is these patients have metastatic disease. And part of the reason that I even said in the PD-L1 high, I give pembro alone, it's hard to continue doublet therapy with pemetrexed and pembrolizumab for 2 years. In fact, I have very few patients. I always end up dropping one of the drugs. We have a whole cohort of patients who are now long-term survivors. You know, we were lucky. We were part of all the phase one with nivolumab, pembrolizumab, and atezolizumab. And I have patients now have been off therapy for 7 or 8 years, and I've never had to retreat them. And I sort of am in the camp that if you gave IO alone, I'm not really sure that chemo IO would have been any better for them. I'm still waiting to see that 5-year data and see if we still only have 15 to 20% of patients who are alive at 5 years. And have we really shifted the curves that much with the chemo IO combos? And, you know, who wants to come to the cancer center every 3 weeks for 5 years or 10 years if you can stop them at 2 years and they still have good quality of life? And so I start preparing my patients at about 18 months and say, hey, you've only got 6 months left, as opposed to suddenly saying, oh, your 2 years is up, you're done. So mentally, they're sort of ready. I've had one or two patients who want to continue. And 6 months later, when their scans look fine, they're like, oh, okay, fine, I'll stop now. But these drugs are expensive. My brain is still very much Canadian. And I think 2 years is enough.
So Melissa, Leora referred to Q3 weeks, but we just saw the FDA approval for Q6 weeks for Pembro. Is that like what you're doing, period?
I think we will. We've been waiting for that data. And it begs, I think, a good question, Neil, that we don't have much data support to suggest how often we really need to be dosing. You know, the indication is for a higher dose once every 6 weeks. But what if you gave the same dose every 6 weeks? You know, that trial's not been done, probably won't be. But I've often wondered how much is really enough. I have some patients actually on Q2 week avelumab from that phase one trial. During COVID, they have not been willing to stop because they're not going to be able to restart that drug, right? And they can restart others. We've had this discussion several times. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it is, I think, their philosophy. We did, for the first time, begin to delay their therapy during COVID. And so I think we'll all have that experience to be able to see what that really does. And I think that maybe will help us point patients that, I guess I have a lot of them, that have been unwilling to stop at 2 years to maybe evidence that it's okay.
Well, Ben, putting aside patient preference, when I saw that indication, I was like thinking everybody's just going to do it. Is that the case or not really?
I agree with Melissa. We're not there yet. And to be quite honest, we're governed oftentimes about when it is entered into our EMR as an option. Of course, you can change it, the dose and the schedule in the EMR as an adjustment, but we're not there yet. But I would agree that COVID and other issues may allow us to realign our practice standards. And we may start doing this. We're not currently doing it the 400 Q6 weeks, but something that we are starting to think about doing.
Interesting. So John, Leora was referring to the issue of maintenance and pemetrexed and pembrolizumab. And again, we got a bunch of questions about that. But one thing that actually Ed Garin brought up to me when I did this session with him that I kind of didn't think about is he said that he thinks a little bit about the PD-L1 level. And if he wants to drop one, you know, he's more likely to drop the pembrolizumab if the PD-L1 is lower and more likely to drop the pemetrexed if it's higher if he wants to drop one. I hadn't really thought about that. Do you do that, John?
So in general, I'm more likely to drop the pemetrexed almost in any case because, you know, I can tell you that after a year, patients just get weary with pemetrexed. You often see sort of slowly rising creatinine over time. That's actually probably one of the most common reasons or progressive fatigue, and it just impacts the quality of life over time. So it's tolerable, but pemetrexed as long-term maintenance does take a toll. So I tend to be quicker to drop the pemetrexed. Now, if somebody was a PD-L1 level of 0, I might be slower to drop it. If somebody is high PD-L1, then I'm much quicker to drop the pemetrexed, but it's pretty rare that I would drop just the pembrolizumab. You know, part of the rationale is also that chemotherapy that you got up front, the 4 cycles of platinum doublet, may have activated the tumor, you know, and we've seen that it actually does turn up PD-L1 levels. So that chemo may have converted a low PD-L1 to an intermediate or a high. That may be why you get more of the benefit.
That's really interesting.